Well, this morning we are going to talk again, going to cover again some of David's sons, two of his sons in particular. And really, these sons stand in stark contrast to one another. In fact, you could almost say that one is a representation or a picture of maybe some of David's shortcomings in his life, and another one was a picture of what he did right. So if you're there in 1 Kings, we're going to pick up the story of Adonijah. And the story of Adonijah might sound eerily similar to the story of Absalom. We find David in verse 1. He's a very old man by now. It says this: "Now King David was old and advanced in age, and they covered him with clothes because he could not keep warm." They're basically pointing out the fact that his circulation was slowing down, and it didn't matter what he did, he couldn't stay warm. He is in declining health. He is in the twilight of his life. The sun is quickly setting. And Adonijah sees this as an opportunity. You see, he's a little bit different than Absalom. Absalom wanted to gain the throne through military strategy and brute force. He wanted to strong arm it away from David. Adonijah is not the same as his brother Absalom, but he has and he shares the same desire, the desire to be king. Down in verse 5 it says this. It says, "Now Adonijah the son of Haggith exalted himself, saying, 'I will be king.'" Sounds similar to Absalom. "And so he prepared himself chariots and horses and men with 50 men to run before him." Adonijah is not the warrior that Absalom is. He is a strategist. He is going to use political channels to try and gain the throne. He sees his father. He can't even stay warm anymore. He's too weak to do anything. He'll probably be too weak to respond. Now is the time. Seize the day. And hopefully David is weak enough not to respond and he can waltz right in to the throne. And so he sets this up. He consolidates his power. He gets Absalom and Abathar to come and to be a part of his entourage. And you can see him, bringing together the necessary pieces. He needs Joab. He's got to have that army. He needs Abathar. He needs to have some kind of religious presence with the people. But he's also very careful to leave out a couple of people in his entourage. He doesn't want Nathan there. He doesn't want Solomon there. And so he very carefully and very sneakily, if that's even a word, consolidates his power. And he has this big procession down where they start this pre-coronation kind of ceremony. Where he's going to offer up all kinds of different sacrifices. And everybody knows, everybody here who is congregated with him knows that this is the preliminary step into him ascending to the throne. But Nathan intervenes. He hears about this. He hears what's going on. And he gets Bathsheba because David has previously promised the throne to Solomon. And he reminds Bathsheba of this and reminds him not only of this fact, but that if they don't act, it's going to be very severe for them. That if Adonijah actually does make it to the throne, the fact that they were invited to the party was not just being rude. It was a signal that your days are numbered. And so Nathan acts on behalf of what he knows that David has promised to Solomon, but also on his own behalf. He knows that if Adonijah becomes king, he is a dead man. And so he and Bathsheba, they coordinate this presentation to King David. And King David absorbs this information. And he shows that even though he is a weak man and he is knocking on death's door, he is still extremely shrewd. And we see him, he overpowered his one son through military might, and now he is going to outwit his other son. And what he does is he instructs Nathan to take his own mule, to put Solomon on it, and to march it down to Gihon, and to anoint him publicly there, and to send all of David's mighty men and all of the people who are loyal to David, and march him out in a very public way so that the nation of Israel sees that David has appointed this man. That there will be no question who the heir of the throne is and who David wants to be the next leader of this nation. And so he marches him down, and really what he does is he skips all of the preliminary ceremonies to crowning a king. And he goes straight to the anointing, and then he goes from the anointing right back and sets Solomon on the throne. Well, what this does is it totally destroys any support that Adonijah has. All the people who are there with him at kind of the pre-coronation party see this, and they hear the people chanting, long live the king, and they're like, wait a minute, what's going on here? This can't be good. And so they see that David has already appointed, that he has outmaneuvered his son Adonijah, and they scatter because they know what the penalty for this kind of treason is, of plotting against the king. And so David very shrewdly destroys Adonijah's attempt to the throne. And Adonijah realizes what's going on too. And so he immediately goes to the temple and he grabs the horns of the altar and he just begs for mercy. If we read down in verse 49, it says this, "And then all the guests of Adonijah were terrified and they rose. And each went on his own way. And Adonijah was afraid of Solomon. And he rose and he went and he took hold of the horns of the altar." And so this is the backdrop. This is the backdrop that we find our story. Adonijah was very similar to Absalom in some ways. But he did not have his courage and he did not have his audacity. So the question is, as we look at this this narrative, and I know that I summed up, you can read it later when you come home and see if I got everything correct. But the question that I want to put in front of us this morning is what did Adonijah do wrong? What did Adonijah do wrong? Well, Adonijah exalts himself and desires something that God never intended for him. If you think about it, Adonijah was set. He was going to be a prince. He was going to be a part of the royal family. He was going to enjoy all of the blessings and the power and the privilege of being part of the royal family. But that wasn't enough for him. He had to be king. And because he had to be king, he eventually wound up with nothing. Solomon actually gives him a reprieve. It was well within Solomon's right to take Adonijah's life. It was treason that he committed. And Solomon says, if he is a worthy man, then we'll let him live. But Adonijah must not have been an incredibly smart guy, because he makes another play for the throne later on. And Solomon says, that's it. It's over. That's it. And so what did he do wrong? What did he do wrong? He coveted a throne that was not intended to be his. The folly of coveting things that God intended us never to have. The sin of covetousness. The sin of covetousness is a doubly destructive sin, because not only do you lust for the things that you do not have, you are ungrateful for the things that you do have. And so really, Adonijah had a wonderful opportunity. He could have had a place in the kingdom. He could have had a very nice life, far above everyone else in the nation. And yet, because of his covetous nature, he really wound up with nothing. He wound up with nothing. What did David do wrong in this story? Well, David waited too long to replace himself. David doesn't give up control of the kingdom until he is forced to. This is the second play for the throne by one of his sons. And he really should have learned from the situation with Absalom that uncertainty in succession is a breeding ground for war and rebellion. He should have learned. He should have made some kind of public acknowledgement. He should have made it clear beyond any shadow of a doubt who the next leader of the nation was. If you think about it, and obviously here in America, we are completely spoiled. We have an election process by which we know who's going to be. And even now we know within two or three people who is going to be the next leader of the United States. But in most of the world, they don't enjoy that kind of security. You think about even Kenya right now, the disputed elections, the corruption at the highest levels, and the war and the carnage that comes from those things. David should have known that, because this is not something that is unique to our time. I mean, this has been how it's been ever since the beginning of time, that if there is not a clear leader, if there is not a outright successor, then bloodshed and war always follow. David should have known that. He was a wise enough leader. He had even experienced it with Absalom. And so he waited too long to replace himself. He outlived his ability to rule effectively, but not his desire to remain in power. Stepping aside and giving up control is not a natural instinct of the human race. And yet the consequences for not doing it can be severe. Think about it for a minute. How many churches have been ruined by men who have not stepped aside and let others lead? I was talking with Alex about the message, and he was telling me about some of the experiences he had about churches in England. Assemblies such as ours are just being decimated by men who are holding on to the reins of power far beyond their ability to lead. And they're just taking these things, white knuckles, into the grave. And these churches are being destroyed. They are unwilling to relinquish control. They are unwilling to have the foresight and the self the self-knowledge, I guess you could say, that it is to know when the time is to step aside. And so they it really is a control issue. They just don't want to give up control. How many adult children have strained relationships with their parents because their parents didn't know when to step aside and relinquish control? I think of athletics in particular. How many fathers try and live out their athletic fantasies through their kids? And they, you know, they send them to camps, they buy them equipment, they're there on the front row, you know, shouting and cheering, and, you know, on the ride home, they're like, okay, you got to do this, you got to, and they're just piling it on. And that's, of course, just one example. But how many relationships have been damaged? I think of Tiger Woods, had a strained relationship with his father because his father was a dominating, controlling man. And was very, very, very involved in his career as a golfer. Now, I think they have a great relationship, but it was a point of tension. How many of us have strained our relationships because we don't know when to relinquish control? How many marriages suffer because a spouse dominates the relationship and crushes the spirit of the one they profess to love? A dominating, controlling person can be a difficult person to live with. David was not self-aware enough to know when he needed to relinquish control. It took a lifelong friend and a good wife to wake him up to his problem. And if you look at if you look at Nathan and his involvement and his friendship really to David throughout his life, he was a good friend to David. He was there at the key moments in his life, and he told David what he needed to hear. He was a good example of Proverbs 17:17, where it says, a friend loves at all times. And when we see Nathan, it's in very difficult situations. And yet, Nathan was a good friend to him. If you struggle with being too controlling or overbearing, the best thing you can do is surround yourself with people who have the courage, and I'll say the tact, because Nathan and Bathsheba were very tactful, to confront you on it. And then here's the other thing. You have to give them permission to do it. If this is a problem that you recognize in your life, this is the way that you address it. This is the example that we have before us. David surrounded himself with people who really could help him see some of his major blind spots. So what did David do wrong? Okay. I know we're going fast here, but they gave me a long passage to cover. If you turn there in your Bibles to 1 Kings, we're going to take a look now for a moment at David's other son, maybe a representation or a picture of what David did right. And there is much more we could say about Adonijah and how David failed Adonijah, but time will not permit us to go into all of those things. But a lot of the lessons and the failures and the things that have been covered about how David failed Absalom would definitely apply to Adonijah. Let's read chapter 2, verse 1. It says this, as David's time to die drew near, he charged Solomon, his son, saying, and these are his famous last words. He says, I am going the way of all the earth. Be strong and show yourself a man. Keep the charge of the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, and his ordinances, his testimonies, according to what is written in the law of Moses, that you may succeed in all that you do wherever you turn. And then in verse 4, this is an important part too. So that the Lord may carry out his promise, which he spoke concerning me, saying, if your sons are careful of their way to walk before me in truth with all of their heart and with all of their soul, you will not lack a man on the throne of Israel. So David has now this opportunity. He knows, he realizes Solomon has already ascended to the throne. He has this opportunity to really give Solomon one final charge. To summarize, I guess, everything he's learned, both good and bad, from his experience as a king. And he gives him, in essence, three different charges. And those I want to focus in the remainder of our time here. But these three different charges he gives to him. These are his famous last words. And I often think about, I'm a little young maybe to be thinking about this, but what are the last things that you want to communicate to your family before you die? And these are David's, really. This is his charge to Solomon. This is a summary of what he has learned. This is the keys to success, if you will, if Solomon is to be successful as a king. These are powerful words. They are they have a lot of miles on them. And David has learned a lot throughout the course of his life. It says here in verse 2, he says, I am going the way of all the earth. I'm going the way of all the earth. It is a reminder, I guess, of the temporalness of our lives. We really start dying physically the moment we're born. And David is acknowledging the fact that he is really just falling in line with everyone else who has ever drawn a breath on this earth, and his time here and his days are numbered. He is closing out his life, and he wants to do it in a way, he wants to pass on something that is meaningful, that has significance. And so he's going to do that here now with Solomon. The first command that he issues him is, he says, be strong. Be strong. Well, what does that mean? What does that mean to be strong? Moses actually exhorts Joshua when he's getting ready to pass the torch to him. What does he say? He says, be strong and courageous. Well, what does it mean to be strong? It can't possibly mean physical strength, because we know from the New Testament that God delights in using the weak things of the world to shame the wise. That God doesn't necessarily need our physical attributes. He doesn't require those things. He is powerful enough all by himself. So what does he mean? What is this a plea for? Well, this is a plea for maturity. It's no small thing to be appointed to lead others, and there is a higher standard that leaders need to be held to. Paul gives the qualifications for elders, and surprisingly enough, many of them have to do with maturity. If you look on the verses behind me, there's two different passages. And just read for a minute, and I've highlighted here some in my notes, ones that I think have to do with being a mature man. Because really, David is exhorting Solomon to be a leader, how to lead. And the first charge that he gives him is one, to be a mature man. Let's read these verses. 1 Timothy 3:2 says this, an overseer must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, and able to teach. Temperate and prudent and respectable. Those are things I think of. Above reproach. Not a blithering idiot, you know, who says everything that comes to his mind. And then in Titus chapter 1, it says, an overseer must be above reproach as God's steward, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not addicted to wine, not pugnacious, not fond of sordid gain, but hospitable, loving what is good. And then the word sensible, just, devout, and self-control. Those are all things, those are all characteristics that I would classify as a mature person. If you've ever been in a situation where you have been under the authority of someone who is an immature person, it is a difficult spot to be in. It is difficult to be motivated to follow the kind of person who can't control his temper, who doesn't have your respect. who really is nonsensical in the way they go about things, who has no love of justice, is not a devout man, or has really no control of himself. That would be a very, very difficult situation to be in, to having to follow someone who you really don't respect, who really doesn't even demonstrate an ability to lead. And so David is telling Solomon, you need to be a mature man. You need to grow up in these things. You need to demonstrate that you are, or that you have the ability and can earn the respect of those who follow you. And a lot of these things have to do with the simple things in our lives. You know, just the issue of controlling your temper, of being sensible, of being, you know, logical, of being just, all of these things. How do we be strong? Philip Yancey says this, says, human beings mature or grow by striving and working and stretching in a sense. Human nature needs problems more than solutions. Why are not all prayers answered magically and instantly? Why must every convert travel the same tedious path of spiritual discipline? Because persistent prayer, fasting, and study, and meditation are designed primarily for our sakes, not for God's. Kierkegaard says that Christians remind him of schoolboys who want to look up the answers to their math problems in the back of the book rather than work them through. We yearn for shortcuts. But shortcuts usually lead us away from growth and not towards it. Apply the principle directly to Job. What was the final result of the testing that he went through? As Rabbi Abraham Heschel observed, faith like Job's cannot be shaken because it is the result of having been shaken. This is from his book, Disappointment with God. If you want to be mature, you have to make it a point to learn from what God is teaching you. God makes a special point to teach His children. And He does that through His Word. He does that through the ministry of the Word here on Sunday mornings, through your personal studies. But He also does it through the circumstances that He allows you to go through in your life. It is not by accident that you are in the situation you are in. And so the thing is that are we going to rail against God, grow bitter against God, or are we going to be mature and accept that He has put us where we are at, and that we need to learn whatever it is He is teaching us? And our prayer should be that we learn it quickly and we can move on to the next thing. Solomon heeded David's advice. When God offers him this wonderful blank check, you know, ask anything that you want and I'll do it for you. And can you imagine? He heeds his advice, and what does he ask for? He asked for wisdom. He listened to his father. He listened to his father. Be strong. Show yourself a man. Show yourself a man. The biblical of equivalent of saying, man up. Man up. What was he talking about here? When we say it in our culture, you know, it might be we're out playing football and you sprain your ankle and all the guys get around. You know, man up. Come on, let's go play. Doesn't matter. You're on one leg. Just man up. Let's do it. But that's really not what he is saying here. David was the epitome of a man, a warrior in every sense of the word, a amazing figure, kind of the ideal of what a man is. But I don't think he was telling Solomon, because Solomon never was what David was in that sense. He said, show yourself a man. What does it mean to be a man? Well, how would have Solomon understood this charge to be a man? Well, in their culture, a man had three different roles primarily. He was the protector of his family. It was a very dangerous society. It doesn't enjoy all the security and the relative safety that we enjoy. The thing that we have to look out for mostly is, you know, to look both ways before we cross the street. Well, a man in those cultures living in a little tent out in the wilderness, you had a real responsibility. You had to protect your family. There were outlaws, there were wild animals, there were all kinds of things. And so he had to be a protector, but he also had to be a provider. He had to provide for his family. The Bible clearly states that it is a man's role to provide for his family. And if he doesn't, it gives this very, very sobering warning that if he doesn't provide for his family, then he is worse than an unbeliever. But also there was a pastoral aspect to this. And if you think about the situation with David challenging Solomon to lead the kingdom, this idea of the family is really the nucleus of biblical structure. Really, he was going to lead this really big giant family, the Lord's people. And so he's saying that you need to be a protector, you need to be a provider. But then the one that you cannot forget is that he was really, in some senses, the spiritual protector or the spiritual leader of the nation of Israel. Now, not in the sense of the priests. The priests had a very defined role. But it was the king who made sure the priests did what they needed to do. And it was the king who made sure that the high places in the city weren't taken over for pagan altars. It was the king's responsibility. He had a spiritual obligation to the people to lead them and to pastor them in a sense. What he's asking Solomon to do here is to embrace all of these different roles that God has given you. And these are apt for us today. The structure, the nucleus that God has put in front of us, and we see this in our own church. We are a big extended family. But then when you boil it down even one more level to our immediate family, we have these same roles. And the word is clear when it's talking to the man that you have a responsibility to provide. You have a responsibility to protect. And by and large, we're pretty good at that. We do well. I see that everybody out there made it to church. You drove a car. You know, everyone looks well fed for the most part. No one's battered or bruised. I don't see any bandages or anything like that. We're protecting our family. But the part where we fail and that we don't really get it is the pastoral role that we have to play in our families. That God has appointed us as pastors of our families. If you think about it in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25, it says to the man, love your wife any old way that you want. No, it says love your wife like Christ loves the church and gave himself for her. That is a spiritual responsibility. It is a spiritual obligation. And to our children, and there in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4, it says to bring them up in the discipline and the instruction of the Lord. Now, it is real easy for us to let the church do the work. You know, you're some kind of sanctified bus driver that, you know, you're going to bring your kids and let the church do this work. Well, the church will fail if they are the only ones who are ministering and influencing your wife and your children and your family for God. They just can't do it. They can help. They can assist. But they can't ultimately be the ones responsible for the spiritual well-being and condition of your family. That is your job. You are the pastor. All of us here who know Lord, the Lord is our Savior and have families. You are a pastor. You're a pastor to your family. You have a spiritual responsibility to them. It is you who will be accountable to God for your family. Not Alex, not Tom. Well, they do have some accountability. I don't want to let them completely off the hook. But ultimately, it is you. You are the one that is responsible for your family. You have to embrace this role as a pastor. We so often fail. We shrink from it because we are so good at providing. Our jobs are incredible, you know. The things that we can do and the things that we can buy are amazing. And yet, we fail so bitterly in these things. Okay, what's the last one? Keep the charge of the Lord. Be obedient. Obedience for David was not just another part of his religious experience, but as we read there in verses 3 and 4, it was a condition that must be met in order to retain the throne. He said, Solomon, you need to be an obedient guy, because if you don't, then the kingdom is going to be taken away from us. What does that tell us about God? What does that tell us about his nature? Well, he doesn't want disobedient people leading his people. God puts a premium on obedience. First John 2:3 says this, by this we know that we have come to know him if we keep his commandment. It is the proof of our faith. Obedience gives us power in our prayers, as 1 John 3:22 says. It also is how we prove our love for Christ. It is also, believe it or not, it is our best imitation of Christ. Philippians chapter 2, verse 8 says this. It says, being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself, becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. That is our best imitation of Christ. The Apostle Paul also encourages the Corinthian church. He says, be imitators of me, just as I also am imitators of Christ. So what is he saying here to Solomon? What is his charge in essence? What he's saying here is that the best leaders are the best followers. Solomon, you had a lot of experience. You've got a front row seat to my kingdom. You've seen all of these things. But ultimately, what is going to make you a king or a good king is your ability to obey the Lord, your ability to adhere to His word. The best leaders really are the best followers. If you think about it, I was going to use an example. I forgot to ask Alex permission, but I'll just throw it out there and ask for forgiveness later. But Alex, a few years ago, I don't know how many years ago exactly this was, but wrote a book on hospitality, The Hospitality Commands. What would it say about Alex if he wrote this great book and he never had anyone over to his house? If he wasn't obedient to the very things that he was charging everyone else to do that. Now, how many here have been to Alex's house for some kind of meal of one or another? Raise your hand. All right. All right. Now they're taking notes of who they need to invite. All right. But that's what makes leaders good leaders, is their ability to be good followers of Christ. If this church, and this church is going through a bit of a transition right now, and new leaders are coming on, and if this church ever gets to the point where the new leadership does not apply the Word of God to their lives, and they just merely talk about it, then leave. Go to a new church, because this church won't be going anywhere that you want to be. Obedience, the Lord puts a premium on obedience. And so the leaders go, so will the people go. The best leaders are the best followers. David's legacy. David's legacy under a microscope. Well, let me just back up for a second. I didn't know how much time I would have, but I don't know how many of you have seen or know about Michelangelo's statue, his rendition or his artistic interpretation of who David was. And really what it was kind of a cornerstone of the start of the Renaissance, where the art the point of the art was to have a interpretation of the anatomy of a man. This was supposed to be the epitome of what a perfect human being, male, is to look like. But the reality is that the statue was flawed. And the back, and they never show the back, but the back, there was a muscle that was missing. And it's not that Michelangelo left this muscle out of his sculpture. It's because the rock or the stone, the original stone that he was, and this was actually the third attempt at a sculpture on the stone, didn't have enough marble to create this muscle. And so the statue itself is flawed. Well, it's kind of ironic in the sense that David himself had some flaws. He had some serious flaws. He was a passionate man. When you read about him, you read about when he fought, it was with the passion of a man who knows what he's fighting for. You think about Goliath. That took real passion, real emotional energy to go out there. When he worshiped with all the energy and vigor of a man who was possessed. You think about him dancing in front of the ark. This was a passionate man. But when he sinned with all the passion of a man controlled by his lust. And he tried to cover it up with a cold-blooded murder of a man who had been nothing but faithful to him. I think about this word of exhortation that Tom gave us when we were doing some kind of premarital counseling. And he said that the thing about your spouse that attracted to you a couple years from when, you know, after you're married, will probably be the thing that annoys you or one of the faults that you find about your spouse. Well, under a microscope, David was a man of tremendous passion. But that same passionate nature led him to commit one of the most famous sins. And really, it'll always be a part of his legacy. The story of David will always be told with the story of David and Bathsheba. David in real life. David had many highs and lows. He made many great decisions, many mountaintop experiences, but he also had many blind spots. But God used him. God used him. In many ways, he was no different than us. Got problems. God uses people with problems. He used David in a mighty way. And then lastly, Google Earth. I don't know if you've ever done this, but when you get on the internet and you really go back and you look at the satellite picture and the big picture, when you look at David, what his legacy will be is that he will be a man after God's own heart. He was a follower who loved the Lord, and he revered his word, and he worshiped him with all of his heart. Paul remembers him this way, and with this I'm going to have Dean come up, and he's going to lead us out in a song. But he remembers him this way, and it says, this is Acts chapter 13, verse 22, and it says this, "And after he had removed him," and that's Saul, "he raised up David to be their king, concerning whom he also testified and said, 'I have found David the son of Jesse, a man after my heart, who will do all my will.'" That's David's legacy. God used David in a mighty way, and he can use us.